This is a Federal News Network podcast.
The Postal Service handed out millions of dollars in employee awards in a program that you might say lacked some solid controls. People nominated one another and then voted on whether they got the money. A few people even approved their own bonuses. For more, I spoke with the Deputy Assistant Inspector General for Audit, Wilvia Espinoza.
Tell us about the program you were looking at, this awards and recognition program for postal employees. Give us the scope of it and, you know, how many people are involved and the kind of dollars involved every year.
So for background purposes, the recognition and awards program is intended to recognize employees who have demonstrated outstanding performance, superior competence, and have other significant contributions. So with the exception of three high-level awards that were processed manually, basically all the awards that are over $100, whether they're non-tangible or cash, are processed through the e-awards system, Postal Service's award system. So what we did was we reviewed recognition and awards data from October 2017 through September 2021. And during this time frame, the Postal Service presented over 133,000 awards, totaling over $76.8 million. And these awards range from a letter of recognition to about $12,500 in cash.
Oh, yeah. So someone can get real money. This is available to everyone from letter carriers to people in management. Got it. And so what did you find with respect to management of the program? It sounds like not everybody that got an award was deserving.
We found that overall Postal Service management could improve controls to effectively manage its recognition and awards program. Specifically, we had 3 points overall relating to the program that we wanted to highlight. First off, Postal Service management did not always exercise segregation of duties when submitting and approving awards. So for reference, the awards system allows employees at various levels to both submit and approve awards. So we found we wanted to highlight that, especially the numbers in the amount of awards have been increasing over the last 4 years. It's essentially doubled. So from an internal controls perspective, we felt it was very judicious in us to highlight.
It sounds like the potential for someone to say, well, I'll give you an award if you give me one, was kind of rampant here.
Yes, that actually leads to our next topic, that we found that employees were giving reciprocating awards to each other. So while it was not as rampant, we felt it was an additional control we needed to highlight as well. Second, we also found that management approved about 69% of the 53,000 award justifications we reviewed, despite them being inadequate and having insufficient justification for purposes of that award.
So that's about, what, 60% of them or so, almost, I could call it a rubber stamp. You probably would not call it that, but it sounds like maybe out of band for what you would expect.
Right.
And this idea of people giving awards to one another, how is that possible? I mean, maybe tell us more about the system, that is to say, where you submit these things electronically. That sounds like there are not enough rules built into that system to prevent things from moving up the ranks to be judged.
Yes, and that was something that we definitely wanted to highlight as part of this report. We actually did find 6 individuals who were able to submit and approve awards for themselves, which Postal Service did take corrective actions. They did take immediate actions with regard to that specific control. However, we still had a large amount of people submitting and approving awards for other people in the system as well.
Yeah, you had 254 employees submitted 598 reciprocating awards for one another, and it was close to $1 million.
Yes. Although in the grand scheme of things, from an overall perspective, it's a little bit minor, but we did want to highlight it as a control-related issue in that the system, unfortunately, doesn't have the controls in place to not allow that.
Right. In other words, it shouldn't even have gotten to the point of where someone could pass judgment on it. It should not have been submitted and gone through the system in the first place.
Yes. I do want to clarify, though, that we did rely on the information entered into the award system to perform our audit. We did not review each award and make a determination as to whether or not it should not have been awarded. So we specifically wanted to highlight potential system and internal controls issues as it relates to the overall award system. So the perception alone of Postal Service improperly awarding employees could lead to larger scale issues like employee morale and retention, which is very important in this environment.
And if you add it all up, what do you suspect or what do you estimate was the value of the awards that were undeserved that went out?
So as a part of this audit, we questioned around $32.8 million in questioned costs over the four-year period.
Yeah, so that's real money.
Correct.
And how did the Postal Service react when presented with this information?
It was a mixed bag. They acknowledged and agreed to take corrective action to two of the four recommendations. However, the largest one, at least in all, from our stance, with regard to segregation of duties, they did not agree to. So we do intend on following up with them through our formal audit resolution process to see what Postal Service can do to help with this issue.
Yeah, tell us more about that issue. What is it that they specifically don't want to do that you recommended?
So from Postal Service's stance, they believe that there can be certain individuals that are given the authority to both submit and approve awards, and they believe that that is okay as a part of their own function and mission. From our perspective, though, it kind of does not tie into the importance of segregation of duties, internal controls, and it could lead to appearance issues or even fraudulent issues as well.
Or favoritism.
Right.
So in other words, your view is that the person submitting should not be the person ever deciding.
Yes, agree. And that's fundamental to any critical business function, any financial transaction. There should be at least two people involved, one person submitting and another approving.
Yeah, because I think even in a standard management situation, if you want to give an employee a bonus outside of a formal awards program, you would still need your boss to make sure it's okay. I've never seen a situation where someone can arbitrarily grant it without a third party, the controller, or the supervisor of the supervisor having a say, in other words.
And another thing that we did was we conducted a survey to obtain management's impressions of and satisfaction of the recognition and awards program. And we found that the survey identified that 53% of respondents disagreed or strongly disagreed that guidance for an award is clear and easy to follow. So that, we felt, provided additional insight as to what the Postal Service could do to improve improve the program overall.
Right. So the people involved at the lower levels feel the whole thing is kind of foggy. And since 21, which is the final zone of when you had data for, have they made some changes in the meantime?
The only corrective action that they did make was the immediate one as we were performing the audit, was the one issue that we identified where individuals submitted and approved awards for themselves.
Wilvia Espinoza is Deputy Assistant Inspector General for Audit at the U.S. Postal Service. We'll post this interview along with a link to her report at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive at Podcast One or wherever you get your shows.
Hello, I'm WIPA CEO Shane Canfield, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Lessons in Leadership. I'm honored to be joined by Angie Bailey, founder and CEO of Ananda Life. Angie has a remarkable career in public service, beginning as a GS-2 clerk typist with the Social Security Administration. And over the next 40 years, Angie steadily worked her way up through the government, ultimately becoming the Chief Human Capital Officer at the Department of Homeland Security. She's been recognized with presidential rank awards by two administrations for leadership, innovation, dedication, and commitment to the country. Angie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Shane. What a pleasure to be here.
Angie, you've made quite a name for yourself as a leader in the federal workforce. Who was the first person you remember looking up to as a leader, and what about them inspired you?
You know, I often think about this because, you know, sometimes we think of the people that we look up to the most as being somebody that throughout our career has, you know, been at the highest levels and all. But, I've got to go back to, honestly, whenever I was 10 years old. And I remember I really wanted to play Little League baseball on a boys' team. I was the only girl. And interestingly, it was the women who would keep saying to me that, no, I couldn't play. And then one day, whenever I was there to sign up yet again, there was this guy, his name was Delbert Beiser. And I remember he had like red hair and he had a wad of tobacco in his mouth and greasy overalls and everything. And he said, you know, I'll take her on my team. And, you know, just looking back on that, there's so many leadership lessons and things that I just really admire about him. And actually, I thought about throughout my entire career. He took a chance on somebody he didn't know. He put aside whatever conscious or unconscious biases that he might have had about having a girl on a team. He treated me the same. Whether, you know, if I wasn't performing, I got benched just like the boys. I got no special treatment. And he was just really honest with me and he just included me in everything. And so looking back on it, you know, really, it was Delbert Beiser, our local mechanic in our little small village, that was, I think, my inspiration for going on to, I hope, become the leader, you know, that I wanted to be.
I'd say half of the guests on this podcast have had similar stories where they reach back to either childhood or young adulthood. And I think as leaders, it's really incumbent upon us to keep that in mind, that what we say and do, especially in the younger ages, really can have a lifelong impact. How would you describe your leadership style and how's that developed over time?
I would say that the one word that describes my leadership style is that I care. I guess that's more than one word, but I care. I've always cared about the mission. I've always cared about the people. I've always cared, you know, about making sure that they had what they needed or that they were developing the way, you know, that they aspired to develop. And I tried to take this approach of not treating people the way I wanted to be treated, but instead treat people the way they want to be treated. And I think that really kind of developed over my career. You know, I started out just like most leaders do, where it's very results driven. It's all about the bottom line. You need to make sure that you get everything accomplished because, you know, that's what everybody's looking for, the goals, the metrics, et cetera. But I think as you mature and you go along, you start to your point, you draw back on those early childhood days or early adult, young, you know, whenever you're a young adult and you say, you know, I think that there's a little bit more to this than just the bottom line. And so over time, I really began to, I think, see a much bigger picture and the entire ecosystem, if you will, and how the people themselves fit into all of this. And that ultimately, at the end of the day, it was all about the people. And so, I think my maturity allowed me to then shift and focus more on the people than so much on results and bottom line.
You've been recognized with two Presidential Rank Awards, two different administrations. You founded your own company. Tell us a little bit more about your background from the beginning and how did that lead you to where you are today?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, like you said, that I started out as a GS-2, a Social Security Administration. I mean, what I really wanted to be was a criminal prosecuting attorney. That was absolutely my dream. I sometimes joke and say what I really wanted to be was a mafia don, but that wasn't going to work out. So, you know, had to be a criminal prosecuting attorney. But, you know, I had to get a job to pay for college. It wasn't in the cards that I was going to be able to go to college without a job. So I applied at the at the unemployment office. And lo and behold, I got a job at Social Security. I didn't even know it was federal, to be honest. From there, I went to the Department of Defense and I found this career field called labor and employee relations. And honestly, it was as close as I was going to get to being a criminal prosecuting attorney. I didn't go on to be a criminal prosecuting attorney, but I went on courtesy of Department of Defense to get both my bachelor's and my master's in leadership, because the whole study of leadership, I just find incredibly fascinating. You know, from historical to current times, it's just something that's just really fascinated me. And so I would say I'm a lifelong learner of leadership. And then I would say some of the other things that got me maybe where I am today is I never really said no to anything. If people asked me to take on a new challenge, even if I wasn't sure I was going to be successful at it, I would say, you know what, not sure this is going to work out, but more than happy to give it a try. And it always worked out. But I think giving things a try and just not saying no to opportunities is what really led from one position to the next. I feel like I was always rewarded for just stepping in or stepping up and taking on the challenges that sometimes no one else wanted to do.
Angie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Shane. It's such a pleasure. I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity. Thank you.
This has been the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm CEO of WEPA, Shane Canfield. Looking forward to talking to you next time.
Gorgeous gaming, stunning streams, unbelievable bandwidth. It's another Lifestyles of Gagillionaires. Meet the AT&T Fiber customers winning at life with hyper gig speeds. Meet Gagillionaire Terry. While his love of streaming horror movies has him constantly on the edge of his seat, his internet bill won't give him a scare.
Oh, don't go in there. I'm telling you.
Because since Terry upgraded to AT&T Fiber with hyper gig speeds, he doesn't worry about data caps or equipment fees.
Come on, man. The door's open for a reason.
And best yet, he also doesn't stress about a price increase at 12 months, because with the amazing Gagillionaire lifestyle comes an exquisite sense of tranquility. Most of the time. Live like a Gagillionaire. Get straightforward pricing with AT&T Fiber, internet that upgrades everything. No data caps, no equipment fees, and no price increase at 12 months.
Limited availability in select areas. Visit att.com/hypergig for details.
This is Claudia's O'Reilly Auto Parts story.
I had just moved to a new city and barely even knew where the grocery store was yet. When my car wouldn't start one morning, I didn't know who to ask about local shops. But I remembered a name from back home, O'Reilly Auto Parts. I called and they pointed me to a great mechanic just down the street. Now I feel a little more at home.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.